Well, we're deep in the heart of summer, which means our insect world is in full gear as well. So we thought it a good time for another edition of What's Bugging You, Red River Radio's program about our insect world with Dr. Beverly Burden. She's an associate professor of biology at LSUS and our resident entomologist. And this program is made possible tonight by the Knoll Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. I'm Bill Beckett, the program director for Red River Radio, and tonight we invite you to call in with your questions about our insect world, both the fiendish and the friendly kind, at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And if you want to watch us tonight, we are streaming on YouTube as well. And Dr. Burden, welcome back.
I'm glad to be here, Bill.
So we have a special guest tonight to open up our show. Could you tell us a little bit about this person?
Absolutely. Her name is Beth Durr. She is a master naturalist. She has been beekeeping now for approximately 7 to 8 years, and she is on the board of directors of the Louisiana Beekeepers Association, and I assume that she is now on air with us. Hello, Beth.
Hi, how are you this evening?
I'm doing great. Thank you for agreeing to come on What's Bugging You and share some of your knowledge about bees, and one of the most important things about some species of bee is their ability to pollinate our crops and our flowers and our vegetables. Tell us a little bit about the importance of pollinators, please.
Well, pollinators are more than just honeybees, but as a lot of people know, they are responsible for about one of every three bites of food that we eat. They pollinate everything under the sun that we have. We wouldn't have a lot of our vegetables and fruits if it wasn't for the pollinators. And the problem now is they're becoming endangered because of our practices.
And what practices would those be, Beth?
Well, as human beings, we are bad to think if a little's good, a lot is better. And we have pesticides, herbicides, even fertilizers. We are overdoing it even in our yards. So there's a lot of damage being done to the habitat for bees because of overuse of pesticides, herbicides, fertilizers, those kind of things.
But not all, as an entomologist, not all pesticides are dangerous to bees. It's more likely the neonicotinoids, but not the pyrethrumins or the imidacloprids. And so I think the biggest message that we can send about that is to read the labels, use it for what it's needed for, and no more, no less.
That's right. The label is the law. That is the most important thing that we should do, is not overdo it, because that is what causes the problem. It's the overdoing. You're right.
So what type of measures should people take to start promoting bee conservation other than using chemicals wisely in their environment?
Well, one of the things that has contributed to the decline in bees is our over manicuring of our lawns, our roadways, our crop areas. And if we would leave things natural in the corners, in the edges, on the fence rows, let the flowers, the weeds, the woody things grow up, there would be more of a habitat for natural bees, you know, those kind of things. We find that it's just dandelions. People will not let dandelions grow in their yard, and that's one of the earliest, most valuable sources of pollen that the bees come into in the spring. They look like weeds to us, but they look like food to the bees.
Well, you know, the classic definition of a weed is a misplaced plant. You know, a dandelion in a field of wildflowers is a beautiful plant, but a dandelion in the front yard amidst your St. Augustine or Bermuda grass is a weed. So it's just a misplaced plant. Now, just to kind of cover all bases, there are some natural threats to the bumblebees, such as the varroa mite. Would you like to talk a little bit about the varroa mite?
Yes. The varroa mite came from South America into the United States in about the 90s, and it has really, really caused a lot of damage to the bees because it was not a pest that was a natural pest of the bees. They have no natural immunity. And a varroa mite on a bee in relation to a human would be a bug the size of a basketball attached to you. And they feed on the animal's hemoglobin, which is like their blood, and it causes them to have viruses and be susceptible. It really downplays their ability to be healthy. And in that case, it causes a lot of colony collapse in some cases. It causes decline of the health of the hive all the way around.
And there's a virus associated with that, too, is there not?
Yes, there are several viruses. The most common and the easiest to see is the deformed wing virus. You can see that just on the bees themselves as they come out. They have trouble flying or they have trouble being able to get around. It is there's all kinds of viruses along as they are. As their immunity goes down, they're more susceptible to even things like nosema, which is similar to a cold.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, what can other things that people can do to promote the health of bees?
If you are looking to have bees around, one of the things you can have is water. Bees need water as well as protein and carbohydrates. And if they have a fresh source of water, they will come. That's always a good thing, especially in the heat of the summer. Bees like a diversity of plants because they don't just eat in the springtime. They eat all year long. So things that bloom in the late spring, late summer, early fall, all of those times it's good to have something that they can get pollen and nectar from.
You mentioned that the varroa mite is not native to the United States but came from South America. A lot of people don't realize that Apis mellifera, the typical honeybee, is also not native to the United mm-hmm. States, that it was brought over by the colonies that settled Jamestown.
That's correct. Most people assume because it's been here for so long that it's native, but it is not native. It is a European species of bees that we have in this area, especially. They do well here, and they've been here for a long time, but that's not to overshadow all of the native bees that we have, which is over 4,000 species in North America, native bees.
Mm-hmm. And what would you tell people that says, oh, I just hate bees? You know, they're so aggressive. I don't want to get stung.
Well, people are afraid of things that hurt them. And so we try to tell people that the first thing a bee will do is warn you if you get too close. They are protectors. They're protective of their colony, their hive. And if they bump into you, they're trying to tell you you're too close. You should step back away. If a bee stings you, she will lose her life. And so that is a last resort. Now, there are bees that are more aggressive, and those are something that we try to use breeding to make sure that the hive is more calm and less aggressive, but we're not always successful in that area.
When people think of bees, Beth, they oftentimes just think of a big nest hanging in a tree because that's what Hollywood has told us about. And they don't realize that bees will nest in cavities. Bees will nest in the ground.
That's true. That's very true. Usually honeybees especially like to be inside of a container of some kind. Wasps like to be right out in the open. But bees like to be in an enclosed area. Occasionally you see the ones that are hanging in the tree, the ribbon-looking hives, but they're more rare than, like you say, Hollywood would have you think.
And there was one more thing I was going to ask you about, and that is if somebody has a honeybee hive where they don't want it to be, who can they contact?
Well, that is where the Louisiana Beekeeping Association and the local beekeeping associations can help you out. swarming is a natural division, just like a flower making a bulb or a seed. The way that a hive grows is it splits into two units, and one of them will fly away, and that's called a swarm. Sometimes they're small, sometimes they're large, but that is a very natural thing that they do. And if you find one, if you will call your local beekeeping association, they will help you find somebody that will come out and collect that hive or help you relocate it so that it will be beneficial and not harmful.
And let's go ahead and give the webpage for the Louisiana Beekeepers Association.
Yes,
and that would,
it is.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. It's labeekeeping.org.
labeekeeping.org. And I should also mention that people can also contact their county or their parish agricultural extension agent, and they will also have a list of people that can come out and help them with beekeeping.
Yes, that is very true. We try hard. We're in the education business as much as we are in the beekeeping business. We want people to know about pollinators and bees, and we want them to be comfortable with what happens around them. It's not all about honey. It's more about pollination than honey.
Right.
Honey is a nice byproduct, and we use a lot of honey in the United States, but it is not the number one reason that people keep bees usually.
Well, Beth, we've come to the end of our time allotment, and I want to thank you so much for coming in and helping educate the people on bees in general, especially honeybees. And on behalf of What's Bugging You here at Red River Radio, thank you so much, Beth.
You're welcome. I appreciate you inviting me.
Okay, bye-bye.
Bye.
All right. Thank you, Beth. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. All lines are open at this time. And Dr. Burton, a news bulletin came by today about the first case of West Nile virus being diagnosed in Louisiana. It has been diagnosed in areas around us, but this is the first case in Louisiana. Could you tell us a little bit about that?
Well, let's see. How much rain have we had this year?
Oh.
You know, and whenever you have rain, you're going to have lots and lots of mosquitoes. Now, West Nile virus is transmitted through the bite of a mosquito. And let me just take a moment to explain to people that not all mosquitoes can transmit all viruses. There's a certain group of mosquitoes that can transmit, say, yellow fever. There's a different group that can transmit malaria. And then there's a different group that can transmit West Nile virus, along with some of your encephalitis cases as well. West Nile virus is caused by a virus. The mosquito normally picks it up when it feeds upon a bird, and then it's when the mosquito takes the bird's blood meal, the virus has to exit the mosquito's gut. It has to go through the body fluids, and it has to enter into their salivary glands. And then if they are going to bite another person, then they can inject that saliva containing that virus into the tissue of a human. And that's kind of like what we call the West Nile bile cycle. The human, however, is a dead-end cycle. It doesn't go any further. I'm not a medical doctor, but I can tell you that there are three manifestations of West Nile virus. One is what we call asymptomatic, and that's when you don't have any symptoms at all. And actually, that is the majority of the cases. Some will have West Nile fever, and only one in five people that have that have been bitten by a West Nile mosquito will actually have symptoms called West Nile fever, and that the symptoms are very, very similar to the flu-like symptoms, and it's very recoverable. One in 150 develop something that's called neuroinvasive West Nile virus, and that can affect the brain. It can cause paralysis, and it can be fatal as well. And so what are you going to do? You're going to protect yourself when you go outside. You're going to use DEET, or you're going to use Picardian. That's also known as Icardian. It's a it's in Skin So Soft, Bug Guard Plus, and some other things. There is a chemical called IR3535 that is also a good repellent. Or you can use lemon eucalyptus or paramethanolidiol to repel the insects. And I always say you have to know the 5 D's, and that is drain the water around your house. Don't go out at dusk and dawn. Defend yourself with a repellent like DEET or Picarian, and dress appropriately, long sleeves. And the final D is doors. Make sure that you keep your doors tightly shut so the mosquitoes can't come inside. And West Nile virus has been around for a long, long time. Well, over 10 years. Not as long, of course, as malaria and yellow fever and such. But there are other diseases that are coming in up from the Caribbean, like the Zika virus and the chikungunya virus. And so just protect yourself and protect your environment.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. All lines are open right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. You can get right in. And we do have actually our first caller online, Chuck from Texas. You are on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you tonight?
Dr. Burton, I listen to your show every now and then. I know nothing about insects. I'm starting to get more interested in them. I sent a picture in about some flies that we see at night on the surface of a lake.
Is this up in Minnesota?
Yes.
Yes, she's got the picture over there. And okay, it's on our website, too.
Let me search for okay. Is it on a yellow background?
Yeah, that's the picture.
Yeah. Okay, go ahead, Chuck. Flies you see at night, I have a picture of it. I don't know what this yellow background is, but they look like they're probably very small, about the size, about half the size of a mosquito.
Correct.
Okay.
And what happens is we're fishing at night, and we fish with surface plugs.
Mm-hmm.
Plugs that go on top of the water.
Right.
And we get mosquitoes. And we endure those for about 35 minutes. And then every now and then, we get these influx of these little flies. They're real tiny, and they're all over the place. And for fishing, it's great. What I want to know is, what are they? And how can we predict when these flies are going to appear?
So you're telling me that these flies are positively correlated with the fish biting the bait?
Oh, yes.
Hmm.
Oh, yeah. I think the small fish chase these flies and eat them on the surface of the water.
Mm-hmm.
And then the big fish are out underneath it feeding on the small fish.
Mm-hmm. Well,
I think what happens is on moonlit nights, it happens more frequently, and calm nights, not windy nights. My question is, one of the questions I have is, does it come up from the bottom of the lake, or is it descending from the sky?
Well, the immature of all flies are aquatic, or they must live in an extremely moist environment that contains organic material for them to eat. And so they are probably developing along the edges, not the deepest part of the lake, but around the shallower parts of the lake. And it would make sense that it's a moonlit night because, you know, sight is better. Fish have intense abilities to detect chemicals in their water, but as far as predation is concerned, they rely mostly on sight. And it would make sense that it's calm. Otherwise, the little flies would be blown away from the surface of the water, and the water would be a little bit more choppy and churning. So as to predict which nights this is going to happen, I would certainly go by the cues that you already have. And I would, if you ever want to send me specimens, I could do more about that. But there are lots and lots of species of what we call little midges. Gnats are normally a little bit more problematic. They're more of a nuisance. But these little midges, and you're absolutely right, they are a key part of the ecosystem, that big things eat the little things, and then the bigger things eat the medium-sized things. And so they're playing a very important part. It also tells me a lot about the quality of water in the lake. Most of the time when you have a large diversity of insects around a body of water, then there's less pollution, and it's an indicator that you have a good quality and a stable ecosystem.
Good.
All right, so keep fishing. And and thanks for your call, Chuck. And thanks for the picture, too. We love pictures.
I will send you the bugs. I have some in a baggie, and I'll mail them to you. If not, I'll have my return address on it so you know it's legit.
Okay, yeah. You know, my address at the university is just address it to Beverly Burden, and it's biology department, and it's One University Place, Shreveport, Louisiana, and the zip is 71115.
Thank you.
Or you can email them to me at beverly.burden@lsus.org. And so that's a lot of way. Or you people email Bill too, Bill Beckett, and his email address as well. But either way, we'll get them out.
Mm-hmm. I appreciate it.
Thank you, Chuck.
All right. Thank you, Chuck. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. And you can go ahead and give us a call right now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. You'll get right in. And we do have one caller online right now, Robert from Minden. What's bugging you tonight?
Hello?
Yes. Hi, Robert. What's bugging you tonight?
I've got a situation in my yard where I've got a bunch of holes that have occurred this year, especially in the dry dirt, more hard dirt areas, and they're anywhere from a quarter to like a half inch in diameter, and it seems to be anywhere from 10 to 20 in about a square yard, and they're everywhere, but I've never seen anything come in or out of them. So what could that be?
My best guess is it's the emerging holes of cicadas.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah, so they emerge during the day. They'll also emerge at night. And you've seen the little cicada shells. A lot of people around here call them locusts, but they're actually cicadas. And then it's amazing when they emerge, the first thing they look for is any vertical surface. That's why you'll always find the shells on a wall or a tree or some type of a vertical surface. And then, of course, they emerge as the adults. And them coming out of compact dirt is not, or I like to call it soil, is not unusual at all. And of course, if there's no grass growing there, it's easier to see the emerging holes. So that's what you got going on there, Robert.
Well, I was just curious because I've never seen anything go in or out, and it just had my curiosity up, and I just had a chance to call you, and I want to thank you for everything you do, and thank you for the answer.
All right. Thanks for the call, Robert.
Thank you.
All right, and you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502, 800-552-8502. Speaking of cicadas, we all know what this sound is.
Mm-hmm.
But I heard this the other night, and that was on the ground, and this guy was flopping around and buzzing, and it looked like he was in a death throw, but I couldn't really tell anytime he got up close. And I hear this constantly during the August months when I go out at night to take trash out or something like that. Is that them literally leaving their shell or trying to break through, or is that literally they're dying?
That's when they're on the ground. Now, good question. I love this. When they're up in the trees making the first noise that you played, it's normally the male, and they have what we call a tympanum. It's like a drum cover between their abdomen and their thorax, and the nerves are making this tympanum vibrate. And that's what causes the normal noise, that they're looking for a mate or they are looking to protect their territory. And you can actually pick dead cicadas up off of the ground and bend that abdomen back and see that. When they fall to the ground and they start to the natural process of they have a short lifespan. And when it comes to the end of their lifespan, they will fall on the ground and they're doing their best to fly back up because it's instinctive that they're potential prey there on the ground. And that's the sound of their wings beating the substrate, especially concrete or asphalt.
So that is basically, they'd like to get back up into the trees.
But they're at the end of their lifespan, and that's just not going to happen. They don't have the energy to do that.
So they've already made it. They've done their deed, so to speak,
yes.
And it's time for them to leave, and the new grubs go into the ground. And
Now, the females, you can tell the difference between male and female cicadas. In fact, I tried to tell this to a colleague a couple weeks ago, and they didn't even want to think about it, and they were appalled that I would even look and see how you could do that. But the female on the underside and the end of her abdomen will have a straight dark line. The males will not have that straight dark line, and that dark line is actually what we call an ovipositor, and it's like a needle-like tube that they stick into the soil and sometimes even to the base of the plants to lay their eggs. As the eggs hatch and they crawl underneath the ground, they spend about 9 months there. They emerge the next year as the adults. They come up out of the ground. Those are the holes that Robert was describing. And like you said, they mate. The females lay the eggs, and then they pass away to give space to the new generation.
Needless to say, a marriage between cicadas is the end of the line, so to
That's
speak.
That's it,
so.
Yeah.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have all lines open right now, folks, so you'll get right in. In the meantime, we had quite a few photographs that were sent to us over the past month, and the first one was sent to us from Dr. Brian Salvatore right here at LSUS, and it is a beautiful image. Could you tell us what we're seeing? By the way, folks, all of these are on our website, redriverradio.org. Just click on the post for What's Bugging You, and you'll see that down, a couple of posts down, and it'll open up and show you all of these photographs. And what is that?
Yeah, this is a walking stick. And there's several neat things about the photograph that Dr. Salvatore captured. One, it's on a glass door, and it shows the reflection through the glass back. And if you first look at it, it looks like it only has four legs.
Mm-hmm.
But we all know that insects have six legs. It actually has its front pair of legs stretched out straight in front of it that almost make it look like the body is longer than it is. And I can tell you that this is a female because males do not get that long. You can kind of go by the reflection off the glass as respect to size with the screws there. And they do have antenna. But it looks like these front legs might be the antenna, but that's not the antenna at all. The antenna of walking sticks are very short. Now, I don't think the walking stick really wanted to be on that glass. It just happened to be there, and Brian captured it at the right place at the right time. But it's a very unique, nice photograph indeed. Walking sticks eat the leaves of trees, and so they are what we call herbivores or vegetarians. And they live mostly in forested areas wherever you find trees. And they are, and very interesting from a point of view that they are so well camouflaged,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they can blend right into the environment. And so most people don't see them until they're up on a surface like this. And so, very nice. Thank you for sending that in, Dr. Salvatore.
Fascinating insect, and I almost want to have one in a nice big fish tank just to watch it walk around. And it's a vegetarian, so I can feed it salad, so that's easy.
Yeah.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. And we do have two calls online, so we're going to go to the first of those. Dustin, please hang on the line for a moment. Charles from Pineville, you're up next. What's bugging you tonight?
Sounds good. Thank you.
Yes.
What's bugging you tonight, Charles?
I was listening to the show, and I find it very interesting and educational. I love it. And I was listening to the lady with the talking about the bees and saying how important water is, and about half of it's woods, and we try to keep it natural as much as possible. The question I have
is, he's cutting out a little bit.
But the mosquitoes
shouldn't
have the water, so how do you draw the line?
Well, I tell you, there's a compromise. If you have a body of water that is not too large, say like a pond out the backyard, you know, for ornamentals, or a bird bath, you can get these things that are called mosquito dunks, D-U-N-K-S, or sometimes they're called mosquito donuts. And you can put them in the water, and they time release a chemical that is toxic to the mosquito larvae, but is not toxic to bees, and it's not toxic to the birds. And it's releasing a chemical that's produced by a bacteria, Bacillus thuringiensis, or the BT, and that would be a great compromise of having water for both birds and bees, but not mosquitoes.
Oh, that sounds great. Where can I get this product?
You can get them at most any garden place, Lowe's, Depot. A lot of garden centers will send them, mosquito dunks or mosquito donuts, and you can just put them right in the water, and they'll do the job for you. It's a great compromise, and that's a great question, Charles, and that also is a good education as well. And I'm glad you like the show. Bill and I love doing it for everybody, and thanks for listening. Is there anything else?
And the name of that product is Mosquito Donut, more or less?
Dunks, D-U-N-K-S, is mostly what I remember having it at. But if you ask people for mosquito donuts, they'll know what they are.
Yeah, okay.
Just think of dunking booth.
Yeah, a dunking booth.
Yeah, dunking booth. Okay. All right, man, thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you, Charles. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burden. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. You'll get in fairly quickly. Dustin from Ruston, you are up next. What's bugging you tonight?
Yes, sir. yes, ma'am. Great show. Thanks for having it. My question was, is there anything like dragonflies or bats that like eat mosquitoes in this area? And like, is there a way to like get more of them to like have more babies or something?
Yeah.
Like, you know, it's like, is there a way to like encourage the population growth of insects that would like, or you know, bats or whatever that would like eat the mosquitoes?
Yeah.
And thank you guys.
Thanks for your call, Dustin. All right, let me answer the first question first. Are there anything that eats mosquitoes? Yes. And the answer is dragonflies. Mm-hmm. There are some birds that will also eat mosquitoes, but not so much on the bats. Most of the bats we have in this area are omnivores, or they'll eat fruit and other things, but not so much mosquitoes. I don't think that they would make a big impact on the mosquito population. But again, I'm not a bat expert. I wish I had Amanda Lewis, or perhaps Dr. Hardy here. They would be able to tell us a little bit more. Maybe they're listening. They'll call in and help me out with the bat question. And the second part of his question was, you know, what to do about mosquitoes, and we've already kind of talked about that tonight, or how do you how do you conserve the good ones that do eat the mosquitoes? And and if Cliff Shackelford was here, he would agree with me and say diversification, biodiversity within your ecosystem. Plant a wide variety of native plants. Do encourage all the immatures or dragonflies have a body of water. Don't overuse insecticides. Go by the label. And it's really just common sense. They have to have a food source, and they have to have a habitat. And you can give that to them the best way by habitat diversity. Did that answer your question, Dustin?
Yeah, yeah. I was just basically, how do I get more of whatever's going to eat the mosquitoes to live at my house?
Yeah, habitat diversity. Habitat diversity, for
and,
sure.
And native plants. So yeah, that's native. The key. Native to this area rather than imported plants or exotic plants from some other country, because the native plants feed the native insect population that would feed on the mosquitoes.
Exactly.
Right on. Cool. Thank you, guys.
Thank you.
All right, you are listening to What's Bugging You with Dr. Beverly Burton, and you can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. Only one call ahead of you right now, so you'll get right in. And Charles from Bossier City, you're on next. What's bugging you tonight? Hello, Charles? Charles? Okay, well, I think we lost Tim, so we'll
hopefully
just hang
he'll call
on.
Back.
And in the meantime, we have some more photographs that we'd like to go through, and these are up on our website. And why don't you go to the next one? I believe that was a butterfly one, was it not?
Mm-hmm. The butterfly is, well, actually, we have two butterflies.
Yeah.
And I'll get both of these out. And there is a yellow butterfly and a black butterfly. These are swallowtail butterflies. They tend to be some of the largest butterflies that we have in the area, and the reason they're called swallowtails is because they'll have a little, almost like a tailpipe extension off of the hind wing. And swallowtail butterflies are very particular to the type of vegetation. They will lay eggs that their caterpillars can eat. And right now, one is, you know, Bill, my brain is just going blank on the type of these swallowtails are. I'm going to have to, oh, the black one is the squash vine, I believe, one. And the yellow one, I've gone blank on that. Sorry about that.
That's not the yellow-tailed swallowtail?
yeah, but I'm trying to think of host plants.
Ah, oh, okay.
And that's what
okay.
What I'm having problems with. But beautiful, beautiful butterflies. And again, a key part of the key ecosystem. And so it looks like this one was taken inside of a vehicle.
Yeah, it would just actually landed on her hand. That's somebody from up in Farmerville and she was just holding it on her hand.
And this one looks like it's actually taking nectar from some flowers out of someone's yard. So
yeah,
that's
very
nice.
That was at the Gainesville Retreat Center in Gainesville, Florida. Friends of mine sent that in too, so they listened to the show in Florida there.
Great. Thank you.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton, and we have calls and phone lines open right now, and we have two calls online. Michael from Shreveport, you're up next. What's bugging you?
Hey, Dr. Burton.
Hey.
What causes the locusts or cicadas that you were talking about earlier to the sound they make? How is it? Why is it synchronized? How it goes up and down? Back and forth.
It's like a symphony that gets louder and softer, and I actually have that on this recording here.
Yeah. The behavior of most all insects, Michael, is literally hardwired into their nerves. Every insect has a brain, and oftentimes the brain is separated into three different sections. Every segment of the insect has a what we call a ganglion, which is like a subbrain, and it's all coordinated through the nerves and through the DNA, the genetic makeup of them that controls their behavior. They're like little robots, and so why they had that oscillating tone, I don't know, but whatever it's doing, it's working for them.
Why is it at the same time? Like, how come it's not just all of them doing it on their own? Why is it like they're almost singing together?
Well, because they're louder that way. If they were asynchronous, then they wouldn't have the volume, and they wouldn't have the intensity that they have.
Okay, that makes sense.
Okay.
Thank you.
All right. Thank you. And they can get loud, I tell you.
I know.
That's one of the loudest Actually, I think it is the loudest insect out there and one of the loudest producers of sound out there. You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And you can give us a call tonight at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. We have lines open right now. And our next caller, Nia from Shreveport, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you tonight?
Well, moths are bugging me tonight. We have a small moth infestation in our kitchen, and it started in our pantry, we think, but we're not sure how or where. We just know now we probably have, I don't know, maybe a dozen or more small brown moths that live in our kitchen. So I was wondering, what is the probable way they got there, and then what is the definite way to get them out of there? I mean, do I need to get a frog to come eat them?
No, this is what I've had the same problem occur twice in my pantry. And what you're going to have to do, these are called Mediterranean meal moths. And they're actually very common in this part of the country. Actually, they're worldwide. And what you're going to have to do is you're going to have to find their feeding source. You're going to have to take every food source out of your kitchen, lay it out on the counters, the kitchen table, whatever sources you have, and there's going to be one thing in there. Now remember, the immatures of moths are little caterpillars, and so you're going to be looking for some kind of normally dried organic matter. The first time that I had infestation, the hot spot, that's what I call the hot spot, that what they're actually feeding on was a bag of pecans that I had stored in my pantry. And the when the females will lay the eggs, sometimes even on the surface of a packing material. And when the little caterpillars hatch, they have these little mandibles that can actually cut through soft plastic or cellophane, anything like that. And they can get in there, and then they start eating. And then when they get ready to pupate, because, you know, we know that all moths and butterflies go through a pupal stage. And when they get ready to pupate, they will crawl away from wherever they're feeding, and they will spin a little silk covering, and then they'll emerge as adults. If you can remove the shelving from your pantry, they will pupate back in between those cracks and those crevices. And then whatever you have in soft plastic or paper like flour, you're going to have to investigate that. If it's infested, throw it out. And right now I keep everything that I have in my pantry, once I clean it out and put all the good stuff back in, I keep everything in like very strong Ziploc bags, because they can cut through that, but very strong, like Tupperware or what's the other thing I'm looking for here that you get at the thick plastic?
Rubbermaid.
That's the one. Things like that. But Ziploc bags don't work. The other thing you need to do is oftentimes the way that they get into the house is that you bring them into the house from food material that you have already purchased. And one of the key culprits is flour. And so every time I buy a new bag of flour, I put it in the freezer for about 2 or 3 days, and if it's infested, you won't even be able to see it. And then, but it'll kill them, and then you can go on about your business. And the other time that I found an infestation in my house, they were in a plastic canister that had a plastic lid whose threads were very wide, and the little caterpillars were crawling through the threads and getting into some pinto beans that I had stored in there. So dried organic matter is what they're looking for, and you just have to clean everything out and store everything well and be diligent in it. Now, you can go online and you can get some what we call pheromone traps. Now, that will trap the adults out, but it will not take care of the infestation problem, because it all starts off with the caterpillars. It will take care of the problem maybe eventually, but I would tell you, if you want to buy some pheromone traps, use it as a monitoring device. Check it periodically, and if you see the moths in there, then you know the problem's back. Does that make sense?
Okay. It does make sense, and one of the things that we suspected that this little habitat started in was some dried whole wheat cereal that we threw out because we recognized that there was something living and growing in it. So that's probably where it started. And so I get it. I know what to do. I thank you for your help.
No problem. Good luck with it. It's vigilance, vigilance. Yes, sanitation, sanitation, sanitation.
I can do it. Thank
okay.
you.
Bye-bye.
You are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. You can give us a call now at 800-552-8502. That's 800-552-8502. But you better hurry up. We're running out of time. We've got about 15 minutes left. And we're going to go next to Bill from Karnak. Bill, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you tonight?
It's actually Brian.
Okay.
Is it true that red wasps eat mosquitoes as well as dragonflies? And also, I've been having a problem. About a month and a half ago, I had a serious infestation of millipedes, and now it seems it has turned into a silverfish infestation. But they're just crawling out of everywhere now. I live out in the country, and I do understand that. And it happens every few years with the millipedes, but I've never seen the silverfish up until this year. Is that just part of their normal migratory habits, or is there something else going on with them?
So if I understand your question correct about silverfish, why do you see silverfish sometime and not silverfish other times?
No, I'm being infested with them. Every morning, every night, I sweep the floor and clean all these silverfish up. A month ago, it was millipedes, and now it's silverfish, and I sweep them all up, and the next morning, there's 30, 40, 50 of them in my kitchen floor.
Wow. That is a heavy infestation. Let me talk about the silverfish first. Silverfish love to feed on dried carbohydrate products.
Okay.
They, especially dried sugar or dried potato products or even maybe some dried rice products. And silverfish are unique in the insect world in the fact that the baby silverfish looked identical to the adult silverfish, except they're smaller. And then they'll gradually get larger. And so you're going to have to find what type, just like with Beth or Naya.
Well, it seems that they're crawling out and dying. I mean, I'm finding them dead. They're just, you know, it's very rare for me to see a living one. And it happened with the millipedes as well. I mean, I would sweep them all up, wake up the next morning, and it just millipede everywhere.
Millipedes. Now, let's make sure they're talking about millipedes. When they died, did they curl up in a curl up?
Yes.
Okay. That's what millipedes do. Where do you think they're crawling out from?
Well, that's just it. Yeah, they're coming. I would walk outside on my front porch, and they would be crawling up my walls. They would be crawling up underneath through the door, crawling out from, you know, just random places. I'm really not sure where they're all coming from. But now the millipedes are gone, and I'm finding dead silverfish. I guess they're silverfish. They're flat, small, flat, gray-looking.
Do they have three tails?
Yeah, they kind of look like a little prehistoric troglodyte or something.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure you got silverfish. That's a pretty good description of them. Like I said, they may be coming inside because they're trying to get away from the moisture outside because it's been so humidity that may be driving them inside. It's not unusual to have these splurges of millipedes and then they'll go away. That's common. They get inside a lot of times because they're lost. And let's go back to your question about the red wasps. Red wasps may eat a mosquito from now and then, but their major prey are small caterpillars. If you look at a red wasp in the environment, you'll see them hovering and hunting in low vegetation. And that's what they're looking for. They're looking for little caterpillars living in the grass or living in the vegetation.
Okay. All right. That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, thank you so much for the info.
Well, thanks for the call, Brian.
Have a great day.
You too. All right.
Thank you, Brian. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we have a full bank of calls, so we're going to go to the next one right now. George from Jacksonville, you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Hi, Dr. Burton. Thanks for taking my call.
Mm-hmm.
I live in the country outside of Jacksonville, Texas. A lot of sand and a lot of scorpions. And basically, I get stung at least once a year, usually in my sleep. In some cases, the stings are just not much more than a mosquito bite. And other times, it's almost like a red wasp sting. So my question is, am I dealing with different species, or is it gender specific, or do scorpions have the ability to monitor the amount of venom that they inject?
They do have the ability to do that. So that would be a dose-dependent type of reaction in your skin. Again, I'm a PhD, not an MD, but the first question that pops up into my mind, George, is how are they getting into the house? And where? And if you have a lot of scorpions in the area, then they have to be living in some type of a... they have to live somewhere. A lot of times it's just piles of wood. A lot of people have scorpion problems when they pile firewood up outside their back door or on their patio or porch. And this is what I tell people all the time. If you can see light underneath the door or a window, then a scorpion can get in. And a scorpion is not coming in and crawling up into your bed for the sole purpose of stinging you. They're just lost, and they're nocturnal predators. One thing that you can do, and you can buy these over the internet, and invest yourself in a UV light. You can buy little flashlights that are UV light flashlights. And at night, go around your house and look for scorpions, because their exoskeleton will fluoresce, just light up like a Christmas light under UV light. And around here, we only have a few species. None of them, you know, very, like you said, it's about the worst thing. It could be like a bad sting, of course, unless somebody's allergic to it. And if there's an allergy there, of course, then we know that they can go into anaphylactic shock. But look for the source outside. Put some weather stripping around your doors, and have a better night's sleep.
Does diatomaceous earth actually have an effect on their exoskeleton?
Absolutely not.
Okay.
Absolutely not.
That's good to know. I hear that all the time from neighbors. So
the only thing that dichotomous earth could normally have a negative effect on would be slugs.
Okay.
Because they're so soft-bodied, it can tear them up. Thanks for your call, George. Anything else?
Okay, well... No, that was good. I appreciate the answer. Thank you very much.
Good question. Thank you for calling.
Okay.
All right. Thank you, George. And you are listening to What's Bugging You with our resident entomologist, Dr. Beverly Burton. And we have a couple of calls to get to. And I'm not sure whether this is Jack or Jock or George on with us. Hello. Can you hear me? And you're on with Dr. Burton. What's bugging you?
Yes, sir. This is Brad, actually.
Brad, okay. Well, they wrote Jack or Jock.
maybe my son, I don't know. The question that I had was that I have tons of dragonflies in my yard. And I don't see that necessarily on any of my neighbors' yards. And I was wondering if that was an indicator of something, maybe some kind of insect that could be growing in my yard specifically versus my neighbors, or if it was an indicator of yard health or something like that.
Do you have more vegetation in your yard than your neighbors?
No, I really don't. No more than they do.
Any difference in the height of the vegetation?
I do have some bushes in front of my house that are probably a little bit higher than some of my neighbors.
If you look at the flight patterns of dragonflies, they will develop a flight pattern. And certain dragonflies, prefer different height vegetation. And I do this with my entomology students all the time. They'll try to catch dragonflies, and they'll be running crazy all over the all over the field trying to do that. And I will watch a dragonfly, and I will notice its pattern. It'll go here, there, and back. Here, there, and back. And so I position myself where I know it's going to fly again, and I just scoop them back up. And they wonder, how did you do that? And you just have to look at their flight patterns. I don't know why your house would be more attractive unless it is a difference in vegetation, because they are predators and they are looking. It may be possibly that you're using less insecticide than your neighbor, so it's promoting prey being available to the dragonflies. That would those right. two things would be the most logical explanations for that.
Okay, and just one more quick question: do they eat mosquitoes?
Yes.
Okay. Well, maybe it's not so bad having around
there.
I love dragonflies.
Dragonflies are the coolest. And there's such a diversity of them. There's around here, there's approximately four different families, with each family having multiple species. And they're such a cool part of the ecosystem. I love dragonflies too. And they're so prehistoric. Mm-hmm. These things go
right.
back, you know, millions of years ago, and it's just, I love them. Good call.
Well, I appreciate your help. Thank you, and I won't get so worried about it from now on. Then.
No, keep them around.
No, go out and hang out with them. They'll let you pet you.
Thank you. Have a good night.
Good
you
night.
Bet. And we've got one more caller online we're going to try to get to before the end of tonight's show. Gretchen from Arkansas, you're on with Dr. Burden. What's bugging you tonight?
I'm having a problem with gnats, especially around, they're coming in and they're beside my coffee pot and my sink. Are they attracted to the water, or why am I having such a big problem, and what can I do about them?
Do you have a garbage disposal?
No.
Oh. Well, a lot of times people have problems because they don't clear their garbage disposal out, and there might be rotting, decaying food down in there that's attracting the gnats. But if your kitchen sink is flushed out very well, then that's not going to be the issue. They are attracted to water, because all gnats have to lay their eggs in water, or at least in very, very moist conditions. Let me ask you this. Around your
yes.
kitchen, do you have any potted plants?
No.
Okay, because sometimes people will overwater their plants, and they'll be attracted to the very moist, organic nature of the soil. Do you have an aquatic bamboo shoot?
No.
Because a lot of people don't realize that that's a plant. I don't know why, but they don't. And
no.
But smells. There's got to be some kind of a smell that's attracting them, and because there's water elsewhere. And
right.
There may be some, what I tell people, Gretchen, is that if you try to find a moist organic source, and that's going to be the major attracting factor.
Okay.
You know, the coffee pot is probably, is it by the sink?
Yes.
Yeah, mine is too. I don't know why people like to do that, because I guess the convenience of it. Who wants to carry a pot of water all the way over to the coffee pot? And
right.
But you might want to take a little dish of, put some water in it and a couple drops of soap, and see if they might be attracted to that. You might be able to trap them out that way.
Okay.
Try that.
Okay.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you for your call. Gnats. I wouldn't want them in my kitchen either.
Yeah.
No, they're bad.
Yeah. We had, oh, this is something else I need to ask you. Are you still there, Gretchen?
Yes. Yes.
We had a huge gnat problem when we were feeding our cat moist food. And so that may, if you're feeding a pet moist food, that may be attracting them to that area as well.
I have a cat, but I don't feed her moist food.
Okay, then we won't worry about that. Thanks for the call.
Okay, thank you.
Bye.
All right, and that concludes another program of What's Bugging You. Dr. Burden, I want to thank you again for joining us here at Red River Radio and for helping our listeners out.
Well, my pleasure, Bill, as always. And do you know the date of the next month?
It will be September 17th. You have been listening to Dr. Beverly Burden, an associate professor of biology at LSUS and Red River Radio's resident entomologist. We'd like to thank each of you for calling tonight, and hope that you'll join us next time for the next edition of What's Bugging You, made possible by the Noel Foundation and the Community Foundation of North Louisiana. What's Bugging You is produced by Dr. Beverly Burton and Bill Beckett, with assistance from Wally Derleth, Sheila Lawrence, and Susan Bettinger. This is Red River Radio, and we are KDAQ, Shreveport-Bossier City, KLSA Alexandria Pineville, KBSA El Dorado Magnolia Camden, KLDN Lufkin Nacogdoches, and KTYK Overton Tyler Kilgore.